Ready?
All right, good evening, everyone. Should probably go ahead and get started. Sorry about the delay, but hopefully we'll have a really great recording for you to download later.
Can you speak up a little? We can't hear you.
Yeah, sorry. So my name's Matt Sekedet. I am a student here at Rockefeller, and I'm also on the board of directors for the New York City Skeptics. And before I introduce our guest speaker, I very quickly want to mention that this is the first Rockefeller University Science and Media Lecture for the 2008-2009 season, and it's also being jointly sponsored by the New York City Skeptics. And I'm very happy to see such a nice turnout from both communities. So just to give a little bit of background on these two groups, the Science and Media Lecture was started last year by a student, Alexi Gambis, one of my classmates. And he and I are now co-organizing the series for the upcoming season, and we're very happy to have quite a few really terrific speakers lined up, including John Rennie, the editor-in-chief at Scientific American, as well as Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich, the hosts of NPR's Radiolab. So keep a lookout for our email announcements with the dates and times for these and some of our other talks in the coming months. The New York City Skeptics are a local nonprofit organization that promotes critical thinking and science education to the general public. We hold a number of public events throughout the year, including an upcoming talk by evolutionary biologist Donald Prothro, the author of the book Evolution, What the Fossils Say and Why It Matters. So that's going to be at University Settlement down on the Lower East Side on Eldridge Street on January 10th. We're also in the process of planning a big event for Darwin Day in February. So please check out our webpage at www.nycskeptics.org for more information on these and some other of our events. And we also have a sign-up sheet out in the hallway if you're interested in getting email alerts for our events. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Carl Zimmer, the acclaimed science author, journalist, blogger, and although he may not look it, perhaps the world's foremost expert on science-themed tattoos. His essays and articles are almost impossible to miss, as they can be found in pretty much every science publication that exists, including National Geographic, Discover, where he's a contributing editor, and Science Magazine, just to name a few. He's a frequent columnist for the New York and contributor to the New York Times, as well as Scientific American, and he's the author of 7 books, I believe. Is that right? His most recent book was titled Microcosm, E. coli, and the Science of Life, and was released earlier this year. And it was deemed quietly revolutionary by the Boston Globe, which I think speaks volumes for his writing ability, considering that the topic of the book was E. coli. And frankly, you know, I worked with E. coli for a number of years, and it tends to be pretty boring in my hands, at least when I'm around it. So I think that it takes quite a bit of talent to be able to turn that subject matter into what I thought was a really engaging and entertaining read. Carl has received numerous awards for his writings, including the AAAS Science Journalism Award and fellowships from the Guggenheim and the Sloan Foundations. In 2007, he was awarded the National Academies of Science Communication Award, which is probably the most prestigious award that a science writer can receive. So all in all, I think I'm not going too far out on a limb if I say that Carl is, in my opinion, one of the finest, if not the finest, science writers and communicators that's out there today, and we're very pleased to have him here to speak with us about his experiences in this field. He'll be giving his talk titled The Darwin Beat, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Evolution. So thanks for coming, Carl.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks to everybody for coming. I have to say that we speakers always love to see a real serious fire code violation. This makes me very happy. So thank you for coming. So as Matt mentioned, Darwin Day is coming up this coming February. And Darwin Day happens every year on Darwin's birthday, but obviously this is going to be a big Darwin Day because it's going to be his 200th birthday. And in November, it's going to be the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. So just prepare for a lot of Darwin from here on out for about the next year or so. You know, it's certainly an important thing to celebrate and observe. I like among other things, to celebrate some pretty good writing. As a scientist goes, Darwin was quite a good writer. He had some really wonderful passages, like one near the end of The Origin of Species. There is a grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone, cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. And I think there are at least two or three book titles and column titles that have been pulled out of that passage alone. Now, for me, there will be another anniversary to celebrate, which will be the following March. Because as far as I can tell, this is the first time that a newspaper wrote about Darwin, about the Origin of Species. There might have been one earlier in the United States. If so, I can't find it. It turns out that this was a really huge article. It filled up much of a page, and in those days the pages were pretty big. And I'm just showing you the first couple paragraphs of it. It was pretty good science writing, if I might say. Included a passage I thought was pretty prophetic, saying that Darwin has, quote, laid the foundation of one of the mightiest changes in philosophical thought. So this is just when some writer picked up this book and read it, and I think almost 150 years later, we pretty much can agree that this is true. I find it a really high privilege to continue to write about evolution at that same paper, the New York Times. Fortunately, the New York Times still has a lot of science coverage. That's not always true in newspapers these days, unfortunately. I came to this situation as a recovering English major. I discovered the joys of learning about science and writing about it. Starting at Discover Magazine, where I got an entry-level job doing fact-checking and copy editing. And eventually, I got to write articles of my own that got longer and longer. Initially, I wrote about all sorts of things. I wrote about physics or earth sciences or so on. But kind of unconsciously, I ended up really focusing on biology, because for me, biology is just interesting. There's always something unexpected about it. There's something weird, and there are some very basic questions that you can ask, like why leaves change color in the fall. So in writing about biology, I have to write about evolution. That is just what you have to do. Because when you're writing about how something is, you inevitably start to wonder how it got to be that way. And evolution is part of that answer. Today we have so much more information than Darwin had about how life has unfolded on Earth. I mean, we have the fossil record, which is so much more better than what Darwin knew of at the time. We can actually say with great precision when those fossils were laid down. We know that there's been life on Earth well over 3 billion years. We know a lot. And we also know about this little thing called DNA, which Darwin didn't really know about at all. He struggled a lot with how it was that heredity was made possible. And he had some pretty exotic ideas of his own that he tried to test and failed. And so even great scientists can crash and burn. But DNA is obviously completely changed the way evolutionary biologists study DNA. And so a lot of what I write about has to do with that molecule. So one of the things that attracts me in writing about life is writing about weird things. There are so many things in biology that are just so bizarre that you are convinced that somebody in Hollywood came up with it. So, for example, there's this creature from Alien, which has this wonderful double set of jaws, and the jaws on the outside open up, and then the inner jaws shoot out and, you know, rip out one of your organs or something. And so, of course, there could be nothing like this in nature, right? Well, it turned out that some biologists were studying moray eels, and they were trying to figure out how they eat things, because moray eels can eat really big stuff. And the physics of it doesn't make much sense, because they have a very narrow mouth. They obviously don't have arms or claws to hold on to their prey. It seemed kind of odd that they were able to eat so much. So how do they do it? Well, these scientists, Rita Mehta at University of Irvine, I believe, and her colleagues put some moray eels in some tanks and just started watching what they do. Now, I don't know how well we can see it with the lights being up, but I just have a little movie to show you. So they're feeding it, and if you can just see, there's a little set of jaws that comes up and pulls the thing down its throat. When the scientists saw this, they said, whoa, what's going on? And so they took some x-rays, and they discovered that there is a second set of jaws, long, pointed jaws in the base of, way down in their throat that shoot up when they're eating something. And this is a little clearer, so you can see it in this diagram. So I was writing about this in for the Times, and obviously, in and of itself, it's incredibly cool. I actually called up the person who designed the alien character and said, what do you think about this? And he said, oh, whoa. I was just trying to make something up that was just totally crazy. He was quite impressed that there was something really like this out there. But it didn't come from nowhere. It might seem like it's such a complicated system that it could not have evolved, but actually, it's not too hard to see where its origins are. Lots of fish that are related to moray eels actually do have two sets of jaws. The one in the back is called the pharyngeal jaws, and generally what they tend to do is they mash up. Once the fish has grabbed some food, those jaws sort of mash it up and push it back. So they're about sort of helping food get down into the stomach. So what's happened with the moray eel is that they have essentially tinkered with this system of bones and muscles so that they go forward, grab their food, and pull it back. You can see the origins just by looking at their relatives. Evolution is also great to write about because it helps to show that even the tiniest little animal has some interesting story to tell. This is something called a mite harvestman. It looks like a spider or a tick, but it's actually related to daddy long legs, without the long legs. And you probably wouldn't notice it if you came across one. They're really small, and they like to live their lives in the litter and the forest floor. They'll barely move more than 50 feet in their whole life. They live very quiet lives. So who cares about mite harvestmen, you might say? Well, what's interesting is that if you look at mite harvestmen from all over the world, you start to see something very peculiar. So some scientists from Harvard went around the world trying to find as many mite harvestmen species as they could, and there are actually a lot of them, and sequencing their DNA, and using that kind of like the way you'd use DNA in a paternity test to figure out who is related to who. And they found this group of mite harvestmen cousins, which are marked in yellow there, and they live in the regions that are marked in yellow on the screen. So we've got them in the southern tip of South America, got them over in South Africa, you've got them in two ends of Australia, you've got them in Sri Lanka. You've got them in these little pockets scattered all over the world, separated by, many cases, by thousands of miles. Now, like I told you, these insects, I'm sorry, they're not insects, these creatures, they don't move a lot during their life. They don't fly around. So it's pretty hard to figure out how you could get a mite harvestman from Chile to South Africa. unless you move them for them. So the continental plates are always moving around very slowly, and things that are living on them get moved around with them. So 152 million years ago, all these regions in yellow were actually linked together in one giant southern continent. And lo and behold, those ranges of these mite harvestmen all pretty much form a continuous belt. So they really haven't gone anywhere. It's the continents that have moved. So these tiny little creatures in the forest floor are keeping this little story of the movement of the continents stored in their DNA. So so I wrote about that in an article for the Times. And I also like to write about articles about science where evolution just throws something completely surprising in your face about a subject that is just everybody's familiar with. There's something that's just sitting there hiding in plain sight. And one example is venom. So snake venom is produced in a lot of snakes in venom glands, and that are, which is then special cells in the venom glands produce these molecules, which then get squeezed and shot through these kind of tubes into fangs and then into the snake's prey. These molecules are beautiful things, again, very complicated, and they can lock into the molecules of their prey in very precise ways, like this one, which interacts with a receptor on nerves. And they do all sorts of nasty things. They will paralyze their prey, or they'll make their flesh rot. They will make their blood pressure just drop like a stone, so they black out. They will destroy blood clotting factors so that you bleed out. Lots of nasty stuff. And venomous snakes typically have a cocktail with lots of different kinds of venoms all doing nasty things at once. So I found out about someone named Brian Fry at the University of Melbourne. You know, to study snake venom, to handle very venomous snakes, you need a certain level of insanity. Brian Fry is part of that proud tradition of insane Australian biologists. I think you have to be when just about everything in your country could kill you. So he goes off and he takes samples from lots of snakes. So here, for example, he's underwater handling a really dangerous sea snake. And there he's got a snake wrapped around his neck. He's actually quite careful about the work he does, and he thinks it's important that people not get into his field just trying to have a grand old time of it. But he has handled a lot of very dangerous snakes and has taken cells from them, produced in cells in the venom gland, which are producing the venom. And he's been able to sequence the genes that encode their venoms. And what he does with that is he makes an evolutionary tree. I mean, this is what scientists do when they want to try to understand how things got to be the way they are. Where did snake venom come from? And so he sequenced the DNA of these genes just for venom and looked at what they're related to when he looked at other genes. And this tree is a little complicated, but the real key thing here is that the this particular kind of venom found in a rattlesnake called crotamine is basically a digestive enzyme made in the pancreas. It's made in the pancreas of rattlesnakes. It's also made in our pancreas. It's made in the pancreas of mice. This particular venom just so happens to be, instead of being produced in the pancreas, is being produced in these venom glands. So what Brian figured out was that the way that venom genes have been evolving is that there's a mutation that causes a gene to switch on at a different place. So instead of, say, switching on in a pancreas cell, it switches on in the venom gland. Because every cell in your body has the same genes, so it just depends on which genes get turned or turned off that determines what a pancreas cell does or a venom gland cell does. And you can imagine, if you stick a digestive enzyme into your prey's bloodstream, it's not going to be very good for it. And then, over the course of many generations, natural selection could fine-tune this digestive enzyme to work really well as a venom, as opposed to a digestive enzyme. And Brian has actually discovered that genes have been essentially borrowed from lots of different organs in snakes and are being produced in the venom gland. Now, once a gene gets turned into a venom gene, it may get copied. And so now you have two venom genes. And now they can get even more specialized. And over time, species are evolving and new species are emerging. And they might inherit different versions of these genes. So now you have whole families of venom genes. And something really interesting emerged when Brian looked at the venom genes in one venomous snake and another venomous snake. It turned out they hadn't evolved these independently. They had inherited them from a common ancestor because they were the same gene family. They're sort of like gene cousins. And he realized that there were other snakes that were more closely related to these venomous snakes that might have venom genes as well, except that no one had considered them venomous before. But he thought, well, maybe they're venomous and we just don't know it, because it looks from this tree that they ought to be venomous. So why don't I go look? I mean, it would seem crazy, but I'm going to look. And lo and behold, a lot of snakes that you didn't think were venomous are venomous. So garter snakes, I mean, I grew up with garter snakes. I never imagined they'd be venomous. I mean, I would try to chase after these things. They are venomous. They just make a tiny bit of venom, and they don't have fangs to deliver it. But it stands to reason that if you're the prey of a garter snake and you get bitten by one and you get a little bit of venom, that could be pretty nasty. And molecule for molecule, these venoms in garter snakes are just as nasty as a cobra's or a rattlesnake's. So then Brian had another idea. He said, wait a minute, let me step back here. I mean, if all these snakes got venom from their ancestors, well, how far back do you have to go? I mean, maybe venom evolved before snakes. So snakes evolved from lizards about, let's see what they have in this tree. So about 170 million years ago. I'll just show you. That's sort of the origin of snakes. So they lose their legs. They're probably similar to their relatives, which include iguanas and monitor lizards, like the Komodo dragon. So I said, all right, I'm going to start going and checking out lots of these lizards and seeing what's in their mouth. What kind of genes are active in the cells in their mouth? Because they don't have fangs, obviously. They don't have venom glands. But what do they have? So again, being the insane Australian biologist, he went out and messed with some really nasty lizards like the lace monitor. And Brian informs me that this is what lace monitors do when they get angry. But of course, you can see his smile on his face. He's not angry. He actually, I think, got bit by this one. And his first thing that he said to his wife, who was there at the time, was not get the first aid kit, it was get the camera. Because he was really intrigued by the fact that he seemed to be bleeding a lot from a pretty small bite, as if there was something stopping the coagulation. And lo and behold, there were venom genes in that lizard. There was venom in its bite. In fact, he found venom in a bunch of the closest relatives of lizards. Of snakes. So the common ancestor of this whole group of snakes and lizards had venom, and you can find them in all the living lizards and snakes. So this was an incredible discovery. And again, it was one that was just sitting there in plain sight. I mean, these lizards have been around forever, and nobody has thought to see whether, to do a systematic search to see whether they had venom. They knew that a couple were venomous, but no one guessed that so many of them were, and that they inherited that venom from a common ancestor with snakes. And it's also a really important discovery because venoms are the basis for a lot of drugs. And this is a website from a company called Vipronex that makes a drug from a snake venom that's used in surgery. And now Brian has given them a whole bunch of new targets to go after. And in some cases, lizard venom might actually be better than snake venom because the molecules are smaller. And so they might trigger a smaller reaction from the immune system. Really, you know, evolution just basically forces itself into just about any article you could write about biology. Just my most recent one for the Times just basically was a question, what is a gene? And there are some scientists who say that we really need to rethink this because the closer we look at the human genome, the weirder it looks. So for example, scientists have identified a lot of genes that produce that are used to produce RNA, and then the RNA is used to produce a protein. And that was sort of the standard idea of what a gene was for making proteins. Now scientists have found a lot of examples where stretches of DNA are producing RNA, or RNA is being produced from them, and there's no protein around. So what's all this RNA doing? Now it's possible a lot of it's doing nothing, and it's possible that some of them are doing very important things. And as I pointed out in the article, and as scientists I interviewed impressed on me, one of the crucial ways of determining what these things are doing is by looking at their evolution. So they're looking at these same stretches of DNA in lots of different species, trying to identify the ones that have been experiencing certain kinds of evolution. So if a stretch of DNA is doing something really important, then a mutation to it might cause some really catastrophic harm to an animal. So animals with that mutation aren't going to have as many offspring. So over time, that stretch of DNA is not going to change very much. And so they look for these stretches of DNA that are very similar in flies and humans and mice. And that shows you that there have been hundreds of millions of years of evolution conserving a particular stretch of DNA. Now, to the scientists in the room, that might strike you as entirely obvious and fundamentally boring. But I have to just point out to you that not many people outside of laboratories are aware of that. And so it certainly is something that bears pointing out. As Matt mentioned, I just published my most recent book, Microcosm. And you know, in a book like that, you can sort of stretch out a bit and write about some bigger themes. And then, so in this book, I was using E. coli as basically a way to talk about how biology has changed in the past 50 years and the things that scientists can do now that they couldn't do 50 years ago. And it turns out that one of the things you can do is study evolution up real close. So Richard Lenski at Michigan State University has been watching E. coli evolve for 21 years through a special experiment. What he did was he started with one ancestral E. coli, and he produced 12 lines descending from it. They're all genetically identical. And then put each one in a flask, gave them a very limited diet, gave them a little bit of glucose that they would run through in a few hours. And then they just had to survive till the next morning. And one of his students would take a little sample of the flask and put it in a fresh flask. And the bacteria that were still alive and that had been able to reproduce and get into that little sample would take off again. And he would do that every day for 21 years. And so he reasoned that, well, natural selection ought to favor mutations that allow the bacteria to grow faster in these particular conditions. And I've got this weird little black and white thing here, which I'll skip. That was just an article I did for the Times about it. I mean, basically, the take-home lesson is, hey, they evolved. The ancestors, for example, were sort of normal E. coli size. The descendants are big. He's not really sure why they're so fat. They're like twice as big as before. And this has happened in just about all 12 lines. And in the way that it really matters to an organism, they've evolved as well. In other words, they do reproduce faster. So for example, after 20,000 generations, they were reproducing 75% faster than before. Now, when I say E. coli, a lot of people don't think, oh, the model organism that won all these Nobel Prizes for a bunch of scientists. That's maybe what some of you think, but for most people, you say E. coli and they say, ugh. You mean that's the thing that I should be careful about when I eat my spinach or my beef. I wrote a piece for Slate a few months ago talking about how actually the evolution of this particular strain of E. coli is really interesting. And actually, in a way, it's one of these cases where you actually have to think about how Darwin didn't necessarily get things quite right. So, you know, Darwin saw heredity around him. He saw that parents had offspring, and the offspring generally resembled their parents. So something was being handed down to them from generation to generation. So that's called vertical transmission. Well, bacteria don't always follow those rules. It turns out that these disease-causing strains of E. coli pick up a lot of genes from their environment. They might get them because a virus carries it to them, or they might just sometimes just slurp up loose DNA. They sometimes pass little rings of DNA to each other. Essentially, it's as if I shook your hand and gave you some of my DNA so that maybe your eyes change from blue to brown, which is a weird way of thinking about how evolution works. I mean, that idea of vertical transfer of genes was really the basis for Darwin's tree of life. He believed that life evolved like a tree. So you had species giving rise to new species. They branched out over time. Well, you know, maybe the tree of life is more like a web of life. And this is a pretty new concept, and one that is still, you know, the area of a huge amount of scientific research. So I like when I'm working and writing about biology to get into some of these things, to get into the areas where evolution itself is evolving. I also wanted to just talk a bit about how writing about evolution is not just about talking to scientists. Evolution, more than a lot of other sciences, is a big collective experience. It involves scientists and it involves the public. And sometimes it's in a good way. So I'll give you an example of the good way. So in this, I'll take you back to this article from the New York Times, which begins, "It has been calculated on data that may be considered as tolerably satisfactory." Unfortunately, we don't write like that anymore. "That the number of specific types of organic life at present existing on the globe considerably exceeds," in capital letters, "half a million." Wow, that seemed like a lot. Well, scientists now would say that number might be closer to 10 million. Some would even say 100 million. The whole question of the diversity of bacteria, other single-cell creatures, is really an open question. So I wrote a piece for the Times about something called the Encyclopedia of Life, which is going to be, if it works, sort of a one-stop shopping center for all the information you wanted on every species on Earth that's ever been described. It's impressive, although there's been a lot of criticism about whether it's going to actually be able to achieve its goal, because there's a lot more work than just sort of programming a computer. You actually have to study these things and really understand what they're doing. It was actually a lot of fun to write this piece because I write for the Science Times, which comes out on Tuesday. They had been planning to launch the Encyclopedia of Life that Thursday. I said, I really want to publish this on Tuesday. They said, okay, we'll turn the website on Tuesday when the article comes out. So okay, I guess it's just a flick of a switch. So I wrote about it and said, it's starting now. So the story goes online Monday evening. Tuesday morning, by then a lot of other articles have come out. They got 11 million hits that morning. Totally shut down their servers. They're on the phone to Wikipedia saying, help us, please. So again, this is evidence that there's a huge amount of interest in what is the product of evolution, the diversity of life. There are other ways in which evolution is seeping through popular culture, whether you like it or not. And one of them is this video game called Spore. Spore is made by Will Wright, who made some of the best-selling video games in history, including The Sims. And it just came out in September. And if you're not familiar with it, what it purports to do is to let you play, essentially, with evolution from single-celled organisms swimming around to animals, I guess you could call them, walking around on land. And if you're really good at it, you will achieve interstellar civilization. So I thought, well, we got to write about this, because this is going to be a phenomenon. And I'm a science writer, so I'm going to go find a couple scientists to play with it. So I got a couple copies of the game, and I live near New Haven, so I went over to Yale and got a couple evolutionary biologists there to play around with it. Rick Prom studies birds, as you can guess. Tom Neer studies fish. And Tom Neer is also a hardcore gamer, so he was very psyched to get a copy. Anyway, they got quite addicted to it. and I essentially was writing about their reaction to it. They felt it was a very fun game. It's terrible in terms of evolution. It's more kind of like playing with Lamarck or playing God, as it were. But on the whole, they thought if people just bear in mind this a game, it might actually be useful. So Tom was talking about how, you know, if a kid is playing around with this before he comes to college, he thinks it would be a lot easier to teach him about evolution than if he's been taught about evolution in certain other ways that we'll get to in a second. It's easier to unlearn the mistakes in Spore than certain other mistakes. And I'll talk about those mistakes right now. So I write a column about the brain for Discover. And I came across a really interesting situation that brought Darwin and Botox together. So let me explain. Darwin was fascinated with faces. And he was very interested in the muscles in our faces. And he was very interested in how our facial expressions often resembled the facial expressions of apes and other animals. And he made a very careful study of all the facial expressions that he could get his hands on. And he published a book about facial expressions in 1872, which I'm told was the first book with photographs. And so these are some of them. Anyway, Darwin made the argument that facial expressions were not something that had been sort of endowed in us, but that had evolved as a way for animals to communicate with one another, to express emotions, and actually to be able to understand what others were feeling. So Darwin believed that we sort of could even appreciate other people's feelings by making faces ourselves. And it turns out that there's a huge amount of research into this area right now. And there are a lot of scientists who are looking really carefully at all the muscles in our faces. And it turns out that a surprising amount of them are also in chimpanzees, our closest living relatives. And scientists have been scanning people's brains while they're making faces or looking at faces. And it does turn out that when you see somebody smile, you smile just for a tiny little flash. You're not aware of it at all. And there's a certain distinctive activity in your brain when you do that. And it involves certain areas of the brain that help you to understand emotions. So in a certain sense, Darwin was right. And where the Botox comes in is as a very elegant kind of experiment. So some scientists put in a chemical that's basically identical to Botox into some people's faces and then had them look at other people's faces. And it turned out that they responded differently. Their brains were working differently because their muscles were paralyzed. So for example, one region of the brain called the amygdala that is involved in fear and other emotions was weaker in people with Botox looking at angry faces. So all around here on the Upper East Side, there is a vast experiment going on in emotional manipulation. So something interesting happened, actually. The story just came out. And my editor emailed me and said, we just got a whole bunch of interesting letters, about 40 of them, all from the same little place in Tennessee. Most of them were handwritten. I'm just going to show you a couple that were typed out. And from the handwriting, my editor judged that these were pretty young people writing these things. And they all said basically the same things. For example, I enjoyed reading your article on facial expressions. Your research into the evolution of these expressions was thorough, even if a little one-sided. First and foremost, the similarity between facial expressions of monkeys and humans does not really back up the theory of evolution. And, I'll just read a couple other lines. The idea that monkeys and humans have similar facial expressions actually points to a creator. The common design of the faces shows the need for a common creator, etc., etc. Here's another one. I really enjoyed your article on the muscles in the face. Gee, thanks. And so on. Here, I'll just show you one more, which includes the line, I think, therefore God is. You get the idea. And like I say, 40 of these things came all at once. So you can kind of imagine the little project that these kids were being given by adults, wanting them to read about evolution and react in a particular way. I know where this kind of reaction comes from because I get a lot of mail. And this one is one of my favorite ones. And this is one of the things I love about having a blog, which is that people write to you right away, all the time, and some of them are really interesting. And Bill, who wrote this, is not all that unusual, I would say. Here's a poll that was done last year, and basically 66% of people felt that agreed with the creationism as defined as the idea that God created human beings pretty much in this present form at one time within the last 10,000 years. So forget about your 4-billion-year-old Earth. Forget about your fossils of humans that are 200,000 years old. When this question is phrased in different ways, you get different results. But the fact is that a lot of people just reject evolution outright because they favor creationism. And this just shows you that this trend really has not changed at all. This is just showing you stuff from the past 24 years. Now, today, of course, people don't talk about creationism much. They like to talk about intelligent design. They say that biology, such as E. coli, this is the flagellum of E. coli, which spins around and lets it swim, shows all the signs of intelligent design. because it couldn't have evolved. It's too complicated. If you take away one part, the rest doesn't work. And if you like that picture, by the way, you can purchase it on a throw pillow or an apron or a beer stein. And there's the address. People have been talking about intelligent design this way for a long time, even before intelligent design became such a familiar phrase. I found people talking about the flagellum as being like technology since 1981. And creationists love to show things like this on their book covers. It's been pretty clearly shown again and again and again, as I mentioned in my book, that there's no reason to think that the flagellum on E. coli couldn't have evolved. For one thing, just about all the proteins in the flagellum have been identified in other structures in E. coli or in other species of bacteria doing other things. So the idea that part of the flagellum can't work doesn't make sense, because part of the flagellum is doing all sorts of different things. And this just shows you a few structures where the same proteins are being used for different things. So now that we're in the age of intelligent design, we're also in the age of large organizations with people working full time to promote it. They have not been doing very well in the courts recently. So there was the case in Dover, Pennsylvania, where intelligent design, with examples like the flagellum and E. coli, were rejected. They cannot be presented in the classroom. So what do? Things aren't going well for you in court. Well, a couple of years ago, I wrote an article in National Geographic about the evolution of complex features, like feathers, for example, or eyes. Actually, that's a scallop with eyes on it, which is very cool. So what happened? Well, the Discovery Institute, which is one of these leading promoters of intelligent design, took this opportunity to attack me, and actually to attack me at length. This went on and on and on and on. I think 4 or 5 parts just to this. And they've written about all sorts of other things I've written. It's like this weird kind of anti-fan club I've got over at the Discovery Institute. This is the reality of writing about evolution. That there are people who are going to pretend that you are part of some evil conspiracy. Like I'm biased in favor of evolution, like you're biased in favor of continental drift. I mean, that's what you have to deal with. I'm not going to turn this into a personal vendetta, but the nice thing about the internet today is that you can respond really fast. So, for example, on the blog, which I have at Discover Magazine, is a post here that I wrote in response, just pointing out all of the ridiculous mistakes in that post, just to set the record straight. And just to point out how weird some of the arguments are. So I was mentioning that some of our organs have serious flaws, what you might call design flaws. And the response to that was to talk about the Pinto, the car that bursts into flames when you run into it in the back. And these people at the Discovery Institute said, well, wasn't the Pinto intelligently designed? I mean, in that case, all I did was I embedded a YouTube video of a Pinto bursting into flames and just stepped away. That's all you can do. Things have also changed in other interesting ways. So scientists are attacked very often as well, but they don't have to depend on us writers anymore, really, because the internet is just lowering that threshold. Richard Lenski, this experiment I told you about, took a very weird turn a few years ago. One of his flasks got very cloudy, and he discovered that the E. coli in there were eating some of the food, or I should say some of the molecules in the broth that they weren't supposed to be eating. They were eating citrate, which is sort of a standard component of the broth that people use for E. coli. E. coli as a species, by definition, does not eat citrate. These E. coli are eating citrate. And he was able to go back and figure out how this had evolved. It's really a stunning case. This might be a new species. He's got to do some experiments to figure that out. Well, the creationists didn't like this one bit. And they started writing very angry letters to him and to the National Academies of Sciences, which had just made him a member, demanding all of his data, all of his bacteria, if you can believe it. Yes, I'm serious. I'm making a big stink about it, all in all. Well, Lenski did not take this lying down. He wrote a very long and very funny and very effective destruction, as it were, of these demands, what is now known as a punnage. What was really interesting was that people found out about this big letter that he wrote, and all these blogs were reproducing it, and it was just bouncing all over the internet. And he got tons of email. I mean, millions of people have probably learned about his incredible research because of this, and because he wouldn't just, you know, lie down and take it. You can go to a website like, if you just Google all-time classic creationist pawnage, you'll be able to read the whole thing. As Matt mentioned, I am a connoisseur of science tattoos. I just wanted to show a couple of them just to point out that fortunately all is not a grim battle with creationists out there. I happen to know someone with a science tattoo, he was a scientist with his wife's name in genetic code and DNA. I thought, that's cool. I wonder how many people have science tattoos hidden underneath their sleeves. How many scientists are inked? So I sort of sent out an open call about a year and a half ago, and I set up something on the blog called the Science Tattoo Emporium, because I've got about 200 of them now. And a lot of them are very evolutionary, like, I guess, the Ascent of Man. And here's a beautiful tree of life that someone did. This is actually a postdoc who is studying, I think she's studying these over here. So she's really, you know, she is really marking herself with her work. So Darwin's first sketch of the tree of life, on a biologist now. You gotta have that one. And I just got one that I put on today of a guy who had wrote to me and said, "I love Darwin." This is an undergraduate. "I love Darwin because he's such a rebel." And so he's like a real punk. So I thought I'd give him a mohawk. I don't know if this is the future face of evolutionary biology, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. So thank you so much for coming and listening to me.
So I guess we have time for a few questions.
Yeah.
We'd love to get you on tape if we can. So, and it might be kind of difficult with everybody on the stairs, but if you have a question, raise your hand and we'll try to get you the microphone.
Did I pick up that Andrew Schally, the Nobel Prize winner, is the one who is coming down on Richard Lenski?
The person who is coming down on on Richard Lenski is named Andrew Schlafly, son of Phyllis Schlafly, noted enemy of feminists, and Andrew Schlafly is a leading figure in the conservative homeschooling movement and has a website called Conservapedia, which gets a huge amount of traffic, and basically is an alternative to Wikipedia, which in large part means that if you look up evolution, you get creationism. And so he's been leading that charge against Richard Lenski. Yeah. Yes?
I'm just wondering, the statistic about how many people in this country believe that God created, was the sole creator of humans. If they ask that same question in Europe, Have you ever seen the statistics of what Europeans think or other parts of the world?
I cut out that slide. A couple years ago, people did a survey in a number of countries saying, do you accept evolution as being true? And they went to a whole bunch of current countries in Europe and a few other countries in Asia. We came, and I think it was something like 20 or 30 countries, we came in second or third to last, right ahead of Turkey. Yeah, so that's where we are.
I'm wondering how you see your relationship to those kids in Tennessee, whether you kind of feel responsibility towards educating them. Are they the audience you have in mind when you're writing your pieces, or do you feel that it's not really your job, or you wouldn't even be able to make an impact on them?
The question is, do I consider the kids in Tennessee my audience? I actually do, because I actually got an email from essentially a kid like that. He's now in his, in his late 20s or something. And he's telling me how he, in high school, had believed in creationism, and he came across one of my books, and he was reading it, and he was gonna like write a paper about it to like make fun of it or attack it or something. And after a while, he said, wait a minute. And then he started reading other of my books, and then read other people's books. And now he's not a scientist, but he just loves learning about evolutionary biology. He collects a lot of fish, and he likes to learn about sort of the evolutionary history of those fish. So yes, they are. And I just got these letters, and when I get a little time, I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to try to just write something out. Because, what I like about that, if I can get back to it, is that these are teachable moments in the sense that, if someone tells you that, let's say, okay, you claim in your article that muscles of the face are the result of the transition of life from water to land, but where is the fossil record for the jump? I happen to have written a whole book on the subject, so, I think I can help there.
I went to a lecture a few days ago by a Mike McCurry, who was President Clinton's press secretary, an otherwise intelligent man.
Okay.
And I asked him, I said, even the current president-elect, Obama, who's come from a long line of skeptics and atheists, had to join a church to become elected president. What is the chance that that this country, 80% religious by some polls, will evolve, and that the populace of this country will elect an atheist or a skeptic as president? And he closed with saying there was no chance, and that he at age 56 is now getting a degree in theology. So I don't think this country is evolving. I think it's devolving back towards the lowest form of non-atheism.
Well, I think that's a misuse of the word evolution.
Yeah, you showed a slide of horizontal transmission in E. coli. I was just wondering, what is the most complex organism that has been demonstrated in, aside from E. coli?
We have lots of viruses in our genome. Viruses related that are like HIV. They infected our ancestors millions of years ago and essentially got stuck there, and they're still in there now. We have maybe like 100,000 fragments of these viruses in us. That's kind of a form of this horizontal gene transfer, but in some cases, some of that viral DNA has been sort of domesticated, and we use it for things like building our antibodies and so on. Actually, an example that I actually really love is this sea slug that I was just reading about. So what this sea slug does is, when it's a larvae, it grazes on algae. And somehow it takes the little photosynthetic part of algae, throws away the rest or digests the rest, takes that little photosynthetic bag and puts it in its skin, and it turns green. If it doesn't do, can't get the algae, it dies. And it actually photosynthesizes. It actually, these little photosynthetic bags are making carbon from sunlight, and the slug is eating that carbon. Now, it only uses one species of algae for this. And when scientists have just started looking at this sea slug's DNA, they found one of the key genes for photosynthesis for this species in the genome of the sea slug. So somehow it's made that jump. And now the sea slug is actually making some of the proteins that are essential for photosynthesis. So the sea slug has become part plant. It's very cool stuff.
So I have the next.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
This is a little complicated in thought, so I apologize up front. But my question is, theology and the belief in something, maybe not necessarily the Christian God, but of something that is beyond us exists in many, many societies, if not all societies. And so one would have to think, why is it there? And then it probably serves some purpose. And there must be a reason that all these people have had this tradition. And then if we go back to evolution and say, well, most of our characteristics and what we are comes from evolution. So ironically, we would have to conclude that even theology or the belief in this God is somehow a product of evolution. And if we want things to be worked out, then we must first understand why it's there, and then also figure out a way to either allow the purpose of it to remain, to fulfill that need, and somehow still educate people, because obviously everybody has to accept evolution, clearly. Has there been anybody that actually has studied why faith is there and how it evolved and what it is from a biological standpoint?
Yes. The question is, has there been much study of sort of the evolution of religion or of sort of religious thought? The answer is yes. Actually, it's a huge area of research. It's sort of gone more, it's gone away from kind of the hand waving to like, the real psychological research that's necessary to understand, why people think in certain ways that are sort of underlying religion. Someone named Jesse Baring has done a lot of this work, and he had a piece in Scientific American within the past couple months. So yeah, if you go out and look, there's actually, This is an area where real psychology research is being done. So yes.
So could theology change, and then
could theology change?
Just change a little bit and still incorporate, to fulfill its need.
You're asking me to predict evolution, and which I always flatly refuse to do. people have asked me, well, will we evolve to not have any mouths because we'll just communicate with thought? And again, I just say no comment. Yes.
Have you done any work on invasive species and their effects on, say, wetlands?
The question was, have I done anything on invasive species? Yes, I have. I actually wrote a piece 2 months ago in the New York Times where scientists are studying what invasive species do to sort of biodiversity once they show up someplace. In some cases, it's a complete disaster. In other cases, islands and other places will fill up, especially with plants. They'll just have a lot of more species of plants. It's a complicated picture. It's not, we tend to have a sort of a simplistic view that anything that invades must lead to the total extinction of everything else. And that's an extreme view, and that's not the case. And so it's on my website. If you just go to carlzimmer.com, it's there. Yes, ma'am.
I saw this really interesting documentary about foxes.
Foxes.
And how they were, because of certain breeding practices, they seem to be following the same pattern as from wolves to dogs. And I'm wondering, is that an example of a new species emerging, or is that like from like this sort of, or is that just a new breed of domesticated fox? Or I'm trying to understand, when would a scientist, from a scientific point of view, call something a new species?
Okay, the question was about these foxes that have been bred in Russia that have been basically bred to be like dogs, to be very sweet and affectionate and really like people and not to, more vocal. And yeah, it's an amazing case of artificial selection. And it shows you that when selection is strong, behavior can really change very quickly. So the next part of the question is that a new species? And I'd say no, simply because you can take one definition of species being that you could put those foxes out in the wild and they would probably still mate with other foxes and their offspring would be perfectly normal. And basically over time, this peculiar little group of genetically distinct foxes would sort of dissipate. You know, they would leave behind just nothing particularly distinct. You just have foxes again. The question of when you call a new thing a species is a really hard question because there aren't, you know, species are not divided into distinct slices of life. I mean, species evolve from common ancestors. And so you might have one group of animals here and one group of animals here that can't interbreed. You might have one group of animals here and one group of animals here that look very different from each other. There are all sorts of different ways in which organisms can be different from each other. When you decide to call something a species is tough. And actually, I wrote a whole article about this. It was in Scientific American in June, and that's on my website too. So I could talk all night about the species problem, but I'll just leave it at that. Is there one in the back yet?
Just want to make a quick comment. Even in United Kingdom, apparently, there's a major problem with in acceptance of evolution as science, as valid scientific theory. Cell biologist Ken Miller likes to show a slide showing that upwards to about approximately 40% of the general public in the United Kingdom do not accept the theory of evolution. And I'd be interested in your comments about that.
Yeah, so the comment being that there are certainly other countries where there seems to be a lot of rejection of evolution, and you're completely right. I think that it's actually, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for this, but you know, one other thing I would suggest is to look at, you know, to have people take a whole quiz on all sorts of different science and see how well they do. The fact is that whatever misunderstanding people may have about evolution, it's part of a much bigger problem that people have with understanding science in general. I think, say in the United States, high school science in general has to become much better. Because, you know, you look at these tests that they give people, adults, and it just breaks your heart. You know, that a laser is produced, you know, is with sound, not with light. I mean, basic things like that. Most people actually think that lasers are sound, you know.
So it's 7:45. Maybe we'll take two more questions and then call it a night.
Could
you speak up, please?
In Skeptic magazine this month, there was an article about twin studies and about how the evidence seems to be building that a large amount of human behavior is genetically influenced. And what about evolutionary psychology and the field of applying evolutionary thought to having formed human behavior?
there is a very big and very well-established area of evolutionary psychology. Some of the research is better than other parts of the research. You know, it just sort of depends on how well constructed a hypothesis is and how well tested it is. But there is no question that behavior can evolve. I mean, you can see behavior evolving in fruit flies in the lab. You can create conditions where fruit flies evolve to become better at learning. You can see how animals have evolved different preferences for food. You can see all kinds of different ways that that behavior has evolved. So to say that behavior could not have evolved in us just doesn't make much sense. So obviously this is not going to be, we're just at the beginning of this. I mean, for example, scientists are just starting to identify genes that seem to have certain roles in behavior, and variants of those genes are linked to different kinds of behavior. And now we have chimpanzee genome and other genomes, and we can look at what the genes are like there. So, you know, I probably will have retired by the time that some really good concrete stuff comes out of that, but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what comes of it. So we had one more. Who's got the mic?
Sorry.
Yes.
We see that religion is feeling really threatened by science. Do you personally think that there is room in science for religion, though?
Do I think that there's room in science for religion? As a journalist, I'm going to have to say I'm not a theologian. You know, these are things that I have not thought deeply enough about to really, you know, hold forth. I'm just too busy writing about, you know, sea slugs and moray eels and snakes and things. That's where I happen to channel my energies. So.
Great.
Thank you again.
Science-based film festival, so go to imagineScience.org.